We hear a lot about a global perspective or a global awareness. You know, think globally, act locally. Most of the new paradigm approaches emphasize that we're living in a global village, a planetary network, and we need a global and systems map to reflect that global territory. What's your take on that?
Well, a global map is one thing, a map maker capable of living up to it quite another. A global perspective is not innate. The infant is not born with it. Hominids did not possess it. A global perspective is a rare, elite, extraordinary perspective of great depth, and there are relatively few individuals who actually make it to that depth. Greater depth, less span. So it's in understanding the evolution and emergence of global consciousness that we can actually begin to implement new paradigms, if that's what's desired.
You said that the new paradigm thinkers often have a goal of cosmic consciousness, but not much of a path to it.
Oh, yes. There's little in the global or systems map about how this interior development in the mapmaker occurs. And yet, that's by far the most important issue. So the global or systems map is actually of rather limited use. It's just a right-hand quadrants map. And yet, the crucial issue is the left-hand quadrants development. How to get individuals to develop up to the point where they can actually inhabit a global awareness in the first place. It's then from within and beyond this global perspective that genuinely spiritual or transpersonal states emerge as spirit begins to recognize its own global dimensions.
That's what I want to talk about. We discussed this in abstract terms, the ladder of development, the climber or self-system, the view. But I'd like to look at concrete examples of this development on the way to the global, evolution towards the global eye, if you will. Let's look at the pre-personal, personal, and the transpersonal levels of the entire spectrum of development, starting at the beginning.
Well, for the moment, let's call birth the start. The infant at birth is basically a sensory motor organism, a holon containing within it cells, molecules, atoms, transcending and including those subholons. But the infant doesn't possess language or logic or narrative capacity. It can't grasp historical time or orient itself in interior psychological space. It's basically identified with a sensory physical dimension. As Piaget put it, the self is here material, so to speak. Of course, the self isn't actually or merely physical, but it is still predominantly oriented to the lowest and most basic dimension of all, the material and sensory motor. In fact, the self is largely identified with the sensory motor world, so much so that it can't even distinguish between inside and outside. The physical self and the physical world are fused, that is, they're not yet differentiated. The infant can't tell the difference between inside and outside. Chair and thumb are the same. This early fusion state is often called the primary matrix, because it's the fundamental matrix that will be differentiated in subsequent development. It is also referred to as primary autism, primary narcissism, oceanic, protoplasmic, adualistic, indissociated, and so on. We saw that every fulcrum is a 1-2-3 process. The self first identifies with that rung, or is in fusion with that rung. Then it differentiates from or transcends that rung, then integrates and includes it. This primary matrix is simply phase one of fulcrum one. The self is in fusion with the sensory motor world, both internal and external.
This primary fusion is beyond the duality of subject and object?
No, it's beneath it. Many romantics like to see this primary fusion state as some sort of prefiguration of cosmic consciousness, mystical unity consciousness, non-duality, and so on. But this primary fusion state doesn't transcend subject and object. It simply can't tell the difference between them in the first place. It's primary narcissism, where the physical world is swallowed by the autistic self. The infant is all mouth, the world is all food. It's a physical affair. There's nothing particularly spiritual about this state. It can't take the role of other. It's locked into its own egocentric orbit. It lacks intersubjective love and compassion. Because it can't tell the difference between physical inside and physical outside, this fusion state is fairly wide, but extremely shallow. This early fusion state cannot take the role of other. That is, it doesn't have the cognitive capacity to put itself in the shoes of others and see the world through their eyes. It's stuck in only immediate impressions of the sensory-motor dimension, profoundly narcissistic. So it can't display anything resembling actual love. You can't truly love somebody until you can understand their perspective and perhaps even choose to put it above your own. So there is no compassion here, no genuine love, no tolerance and benevolence and altruism. So in many ways, this fusion state is the complete antithesis of genuine spiritual awareness and compassion and love. Of course, we can't rule out the fact that the infant has access to some types of spiritual states. As we said, altered states and peak experiences can occur at almost any stage of development. Nonetheless, even if the infant has a fluid access to some types of spiritual states, those states still must be converted into permanent traits if spirituality is to become a mature, stable, constant awareness, capable of taking the role of other and being reflected in genuine love and care. So once again, states might be important, but stages are even more important.
Now, what about the previous intrauterine state? Do you include that in your model?
The evidence centering on the intrauterine state and the birth trauma is highly controversial, but I suspect some of it is legitimate, so I refer to these even earlier developments as fulcrum zero. Like all fulcrums, it has that essential 1-2-3 structure, an initial fusion with the womb, then a painful process of differentiation, the actual birth trauma, then a period of consolidation and integration as a differentiated organism, posterior. At that point, the infant self has then begun fulcrum one. It is now fused with the physical world in and around it.
So let's go through the 1-2-3 process of fulcrum one.
Well, the self is in fusion with the sensory motor world, the primary fusion state or primary narcissism. The self's identity is physiocentric, fused with the material dimension, with the physiosphere. But somewhere around 4 months, the infant will begin to differentiate between physical sensations in its body and those in the environment. The infant bites a blanket and it doesn't hurt, bites its thumb and it does. There is a difference, it learns, between blanket and thumb. So it begins the differentiation phase of fulcrum one, which is usually completed sometime in the first year, usually around 5 to 9 months, according to Margaret Mahler, a pioneer in this research. She calls this the hatching phase. The physical self hatches out of this primary fusion matrix. This hatching is the real birth, so to speak, of the physical self. Melanie Klein was particularly interested in this earliest of differentiations, as were Edith Jacobson and Renee Spitz, not to mention Margaret Mahler. This hatching is the birth of the physical self. If the self fails in this differentiation, if it remains stuck or in fusion with the primary matrix, then it can't tell where its body stops and the chair begins. It's open to what is called a-dualism, which is one of the primary characteristics of psychosis. And that is why research consistently indicates that many of the really severe pathologies, psychosis, schizophrenia, severe affective disorders, have part of their etiology in problems with this early fulcrum, fulcrum one. So we can start to see that a type of pathology is associated with the level at which the disruption occurs. With psychosis, there's severe reality distortion, marked especially by a-dualism, or the incapacity to establish even the physical boundaries of the self, fulcrum one. There are often hallucinatory primary process images and thoughts, narcissistic delusions of reference. Consciousness fails to seat in the physical body. Thoughts of self and other are confused. There may also be an influx of subtle or transpersonal awareness, but this is fairly rare and is often badly distorted as well.
And if all goes well with fulcrum one?
If this fulcrum is negotiated relatively well, then the infant will begin fulcrum two, the emotional phantasmic fulcrum. Because the infant has completed fulcrum one, it has established the realistic boundaries of its physical self, but it still hasn't yet established the boundaries of its emotional self. So it can differentiate its physical self from the physical environment, but it still cannot differentiate its emotional self from the emotional environment. And this means that its emotional self is fused or identified with those around it, particularly the mother. And just as there was nothing deep or profound about the previous physical fusion state, there's nothing deep or profound about this emotional fusion state, even though it, too, sounds like a nice holistic oneness with the world. But in fact, researchers are virtually unanimous in pointing out that this stage is still extremely egocentric or narcissistic. As Mahler puts it, the self at this stage treats the world like its oyster. Precisely because it cannot differentiate itself from the emotional and vital world around it, the infant self treats the world as an extension of itself, which is the technical meaning of narcissism. So this type of severe narcissism, which is normal, not pathological at this stage, does not mean that the infant thinks selfishly about only itself, but on the contrary, it is incapable of thinking about itself. It is unable to differentiate itself from the world, the emotional world, and so it thinks that what it is feeling is what the world is feeling, that what it wants is what the world wants, that what it sees is what the world sees. It plays hide-and-seek in plain view. It thinks that if it can't see you, you can't see it. Its own perspective is the only perspective in existence. In other words, the self here is a purely ecological self, a biospheric self, a libidinal self, a natural impulsive self. It is one with, in fusion with, the entire vital emotional dimension of being, both internal and external. It's pushed and pulled by the currents of its vital life, and it does not differentiate itself from the ecological currents of existence. Its identity is biocentric or ecocentric, fused with the biosphere within and without. And precisely because it is embedded in nature, in biology, in impulse, in the vital emotional sphere, it cannot rise above that embeddedness and see that its perspective is not the only perspective in existence. Biocentric is extremely egocentric, as we will constantly see. It might have a certain horizontal expanse, but very little vertical depth, which is why it's so shallow and narcissistic, despite the use to which this emotional fusion has been put by romantics in a search for any sort of union. I sympathize with their search, but I believe they're mistaken to look for it here.
So the self at this stage has no sturdy emotional boundaries.
Yes, that's right. Technically, we say self and object representations are still fused. This contributes to the general narcissistic atmosphere that's so prevalent at this stage. But somewhere around 15 to 24 months, the emotional self begins to differentiate itself from the emotional environment. Mahler actually calls this the psychological birth of the infant. The infant is actually born as a separate emotional and feeling self at this stage. The infant starts to wake up to the fact that it is a separate self existing in a separate world. It has hit the terrible twos.
Which is different from hatching.
Right. Fulcrum 1 is hatching, or the birth of the physical self. Fulcrum 2 is the birth of the emotional self. With Fulcrum 2, a truly separate self-sense awakens, with all the joy and all the terror that involves.
Many theorists take this as the beginning of alienation, of really profound alienation. They've called it the basic fault, the basic default, the basic dualism, the split between subject and object, or the beginning of the fragmented awareness.
Yes. An extraordinary amount has been read into this differentiation and the loss of the previous emotional fusion. It's supposed to be the ejection from a primal paradise, the beginning of massive alienation, the start of the human tragedy, the beginning of paradise lost. Well, the basic problem is that most of these theorists simply confuse differentiation with dissociation. Differentiation is a necessary and unavoidable part of all evolutionary growth and development, the counterpart to reaching higher integration, as when an acorn differentiates and integrates in order to become an oak. But these theorists look at any differentiation not as prelude to higher integration, but as a brutal disruption of a prior and wonderful harmony. Just because the self is not aware of suffering doesn't mean it has a positive presence of spiritual bliss. Lack of awareness doesn't mean presence of paradise.
But the romantics, as you call them, seem to assume otherwise about this early lack of differentiation. They read many positive virtues into it. so they must see the loss of this fusion as lamentable.
Well, yes, they confuse fusion with freedom. But fusion is imprisonment. You're dominated by all that you have not transcended. But, of course, that transcendental growth is difficult and perilous and painful. The manifest world is a brutal place. As humans become aware of this, they suffer. The manifest world, the world of samsara, is an alienated and alienating place. And as the infant becomes vaguely aware of that, it suffers horribly. And yes, this is painful, but it's called waking up. It's like frostbite disease. First, there's no feeling at all. Everything seems fine. You're in a paradise of no pain. You're diseased, you just don't know it. Then it thaws out, and feelings and emotions emerge, and it hurts like hell. These theorists confuse hurts like hell with the disease itself. No, Fulcrum 2 is simply starting to wake up to the disease of samsara, to the fact that, as a separate and sensitive emotional being, you're open to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. You're going to be put into a world of pain and suffering, a nightmarish hell, and you have two and only two choices. Retreat to the prior fusion, the prior frostbite, where there was no awareness of this alienation, or continue growth and transcendence until you can transcend this alienation in spiritual awakening. But the retro-romantic theorists simply eulogize the prior frostbitten state and see that as a prefiguration of the divine awakening, as being itself a type of unconscious heaven. But the fusion state is not unconscious heaven, it's unconscious hell. With Fulcrum 2, that hell becomes conscious, that's all. It's a big advance.
Even though Fulcrum 2 is a rather unhappy development?
Bittersweet, yes. But the previous state is the state of numbness, not non-duality, ignorance, not bliss. My dog doesn't writhe in angst either, but liberation does not consist in reawakening dog consciousness, or a mature form of dog consciousness. When we awaken as a separate emotional self with all the joy and all the terror that involves, we have actually transcended the previous fusion state. We have awakened to some degree. We have gained more depth and more consciousness, and that has its own intrinsic value, intrinsic worth. But like all stages of growth, there's a price to be paid for every increase in consciousness. The dialectic of progress.
So if everything goes relatively well at this Fulcrum 2?
Well, let me first say that if things go poorly at this fulcrum, that is, worse than the normal mess this fulcrum is anyway, then the self either remains in fusion at this emotionally narcissistic stage, the so-called narcissistic personality disorders, or the differentiation process begins but is not resolved, and there's some sort of dissociation, that's the so-called borderline disorders. We find exactly this general classification and etiology in Kohut, Masterson, Kernberg, Mahler, Stone, and Geddo, to name a few. In either case, there are no realistic emotional boundaries to the self. In the narcissistic and borderline syndromes, the individual therefore lacks a sense of cohesive self, and this is perhaps the central defining characteristic of these pathologies. The self either treats the world as an extension of itself, narcissistic, or is constantly invaded and tortured by the world, borderline. This level of pathology is called borderline because it is borderline between psychosis and neurosis. It's sometimes called stably unstable. The growing self has taken a painful spill at the second big fork in the road.
But if all goes well at Fulcrum 2?
Well, if all goes relatively well, then the self is no longer exclusively identified with the emotional level. It begins to transcend that level and identify with the mental or conceptual self, which is the beginning of Fulcrum 3 and the representational mind. The representational mind is similar to what Piaget called pre-operational cognition. As I use it, the representational mind, or just rep mind, consists of images, symbols, and concepts. Images begin to emerge around 7 months. A mental image looks more or less like the object it represents. If you close your eyes and picture a dog, it looks pretty much like a real dog. That's an image. A symbol, on the other hand, represents an object, but does not look like the object at all, which is a much harder cognitive task. The symbol Fido represents my dog, but it doesn't look like my dog at all. Symbols emerge during the second year, usually with words like ma or dada, and develop very rapidly. Symbols dominate awareness from roughly 2 to 4 years, at which point concepts begin to emerge. Where a simple symbol represents a single object, a concept represents an entire class of objects. The word dog represents all dogs, not just Fido, an even harder task. Concepts dominate awareness from 4 to 7 years. Of course, these are all basic units or holons of consciousness, so once they emerge in awareness, they will remain as basic capacities available to consciousness. But it's when concepts emerge that a particularly mental self, a conceptual self, begins to emerge. When the self begins to identify with this conceptual mind, we have fulcrum 3. The self is now not just a bundle of sensations and impulses and emotions. It is also a set of symbols and concepts. It begins to enter the linguistic world, the noospheric world, and this, to put it mildly, changes everything. It has gone from the physiosphere of fulcrum 1 to the biosphere of fulcrum 2, and now it begins to enter the noosphere with fulcrum 3.
What would you say is the single most important thing about this new linguistic self?
This new self exists in the noosphere, and the noosphere can repress the biosphere. Individually, this produces neurosis. Collectively, ecological crisis. In other words, the linguistic world is indeed a new world space. Here the self can think of the past and plan for the future. It's temporal and historical. It can begin to control its bodily functions. It can begin to picture things in its mind that are not actually present in its senses. Because it can anticipate the future, it can worry and suffer anxiety. And because it can think about the past, it can feel remorse and guilt and regret. All of these are part of its new world space, the linguistic world, the noosphere. And precisely because it exists in this new and wider world, the conceptual mind can repress and dissociate its lower impulses. That is, precisely because the noosphere transcends the biosphere, it can not only transcend and include, it can repress and distort and deny. Not just differentiate, but dissociate, both individually and at large. Individually, neurosis, at large, ecological crisis.
For the moment, let's just consider the individual.
Well, on an individual level, the result of the noosphere repressing the biosphere is called psychoneurosis, or simply neurosis. The mind can repress nature, both external nature, eco-crisis, and internal nature, libido. Psychoneurosis, or just neurosis, in the technical sense means that a fairly stable, cohesive mental self has emerged, and this mental conceptual self, the ego, can repress or dissociate aspects of its bodily drives or impulses, and these repressed or distorted impulses, usually sexual or aggressive, therefore appear in disguised and painful forms known as neurotic symptoms. In other words, every neurotic symptom is a miniature ecological crisis.
So it's interesting that repression proper and the classical neuroses come into being with fulcrum 3.
In a general sense, yes. You see, in the previous borderline conditions, repression proper is not so much in evidence. The self isn't strong enough to repress anything. The self can't repress its emotions, but rather it's completely overwhelmed by them, lost in them, flooded by them. There's no repressed unconscious to dig up, because there is no extensive repression in the first place, which is why these conditions are often referred to as pre-neurotic. So therapies aimed at the borderline conditions, fulcrum 2, are actually known as structure-building therapies. They help the fragile self to differentiate and stabilize and build boundaries, as opposed to the uncovering therapies of the neurotic level, fulcrum 3, which aim at relaxing the repression barrier and recontacting the impulses and emotions and felt sense that the stronger neurotic self has repressed. In fact, one of the aims of structure-building therapy is to get the borderline up to a capacity for repression.
So neurosis is an improvement.
Yes, and then you have to deal with that. The point is, the defense mechanisms themselves exist in a hierarchy of development. A typical Fulcrum 1 defense mechanism is projective identification, where self and other are largely undifferentiated. Typical Fulcrum 2 defense mechanisms include splitting and fusion, fusion of self and object representations, and a splitting of all good and all bad objects. Repression proper is typical of Fulcrum 3 defense mechanisms, and this is said to eventually give way to the healthiest defense of all, sublimation, which is just a psychoanalytically decontaminated word for transcendence.
So defense mechanisms are holarchically arranged.
Well, in many ways, yes. Defense mechanisms, when operating naturally and normally, are like a psychological immune system. They help maintain the integrity and stability of the self boundary, and they toss out any invaders that threaten the self system. But as always, there can be too much of a good thing. Defense mechanisms can become an autoimmune disorder. The self starts attacking itself, eating itself up. The defending army turns into a repressive state police. The self starts defending against pain and terror by incarcerating its own citizens. It seals off its own potential. It closes its eyes. It starts to lie. No matter what the level of this lie, from splitting and fusion and projection to repression and reaction formation and displacement, the self hides from itself, lies to itself, becomes opaque to itself. In place of the actual self, there grows up the false self. Beginning as early as Fulcrum 1, some would say Fulcrum 0, the fledgling and growing self can begin to distance itself from aspects of its own being, aspects that are too threatening, too painful, or too disruptive. It does so using the defense mechanisms available to it at its own level of development. The psychotic lie, the borderline lie, the neurotic lie, and so on. The unconscious, in the most general sense, is simply the locus of the running lie, the layers of deception, layers of insincerity, hiding the actual self and its real potentials.
So what happens to this false self, this inauthentic self?
The inauthentic self, at whatever level, might simply remain in charge for a lifetime, as the individual limps through a life of internal insincerity. More often than not, however, the inauthentic self will at some point collapse under its own suffocating weight. There's a breakdown, and the individual is then faced with several choices. Rest and recover, and then resume the same inauthentic self trajectory. Drug the dilemma out of awareness. Behaviorally reinforce actions that avoid the problem. Or take up an investigation into the life of the lie, usually with a therapist who will help you interpret your interior intentions more truthfully.
So these are the interpretive or left-hand quadrant therapies.
Right. In a safe environment, surrounded by empathy, congruence, and acceptance, the individual can begin to tell the truth about his or her interior without fear of retribution. And thus, the inauthentic self, at whatever level, tends to lose the reason for its existence. The lie, the resistance to truthfulness, is interpreted, and the concealed pain and terror and anguish disclose themselves, and the inauthentic self slowly burns in the fire of truthful awareness. The truthful interiors are shared in an intersubjective circle of care and compassion, which releases them from their imprisonment in deception and allows them to join the ongoing growth of consciousness. The beauty of the actual self shines through, and the intrinsic joy of the new depth is its own reward. Now, we've only discussed the first three fulcrums and the pathologies that develop up to those points, psychosis, borderline, neurosis. But the same general phenomenon is operative throughout development, even into the higher and transpersonal domains. At whatever level of development, we can exist as the actual self in sincerity or the inauthentic self in deception, and the different levels of the lie are the different levels of pathology.
That takes us up through Fulcrum 3, the first three major spheres or pre-personal levels of consciousness growth, each of which has a different worldview.
Right. A worldview, as we were saying, is what the cosmos looks like from a particular rung of consciousness. When you have only sensations and impulses, what does the cosmos look like to you? We call that an archaic worldview. When you add images and symbols, what does the cosmos look like then? a magical worldview. When you add rules and roles, what does the cosmos see? A mythic world. When formal operational thinking emerges, what do you see? A rational world, and so on.
Would you briefly summarize the early worldviews, and then we can move on to higher developments?
Well, archaic is sort of a catch-all phrase. It loosely represents all the previous stages up to the hominid. Archaic is the general worldview of Fulcrum I. It's basically a sensory-motor worldview.
And the magical worldview?
As images and symbols begin to emerge around the time of Fulcrum II, these early images and symbols are not differentiated clearly from the objects they represent. Thus, it seems that to manipulate the image is to actually change the object. The child lives in this world of magical displacement and condensation. Very primary process, very magical. Likewise, because self and other are not well differentiated, the child populates its world with objects that have mental characteristics. The magical worldview is animistic. And I'm not talking about some sort of sophisticated panpsychic philosophy. It's very crude and very egocentric. The clouds move because they're following you. They want to see you. It rains because the sky wants to wash you off. It thunders because the sky is angry at you personally. Mind and world are not clearly differentiated, so their characteristics tend to get fused and confused magically. Inside and outside are both egocentric, narcissistic.
Now, what about the mythic worldview?
As development moves into Fulcrum III, the child begins to understand that it cannot itself magically order the world around. It keeps hiding under the pillow, but people keep finding it. Something is not working here. Magic doesn't really work. The self can't really order the world around magically and omnipotently. But it thinks perhaps somebody else can, and so crashing onto the scene come a pantheon of gods and goddesses and demons and fairies and special forces, all of which can miraculously suspend the laws of nature for various, often trite and trivial reasons. The child will ask its parents to turn the yucky spinach into candy. The child doesn't understand that the material world doesn't work like that. But in the meantime, the child develops a very complex mythological worldview, which is populated with all sorts of egocentric forces that are imagined to order the world around, and all of them are focused on the ego of the child. Whereas in the previous magical phase, the infant thought that it itself could alter the world by the right word magic. Now it has to spend its time trying to appease the gods and demons and forces that can alter the world, often for the worse. Egocentric power gives way to egocentric prayer and ritual. There is a constant bargaining with these forces. This mythic worldview begins with the rep mind and continues into the next major stage, the rule-role mind. And then dies down with a rational worldview, which realizes that if you want to change reality, you must work at it yourself. Nobody's going to magically or mythically save you without a corresponding growth. Worldviews are listed in the lower left quadrant because they collectively govern individual perceptions within their horizon.
Okay, so I'm starting to see more clearly how you correlate the developments in the upper left quadrant with developments in the lower left quadrant. And that brings us to Fulcrum 4, the basic rung that you've listed as the rule-role mind.
Yes, this is roughly what Piaget called concrete operational cognition, CONOP, which emerges around age 6 to 7 on average, and dominates awareness until roughly age 11 to 14. Concrete operational sounds very dry and arid, but it's actually very rich and powerful. It involves the capacity to form mental rules and to take mental roles. And, this is crucial, the child finally learns to take the role of other. There's a famous experiment by Piaget and Inhelder that first spotted this very clearly. I'll give a simplified version. If you take a ball colored red on one side and green on the other, and you place the ball between you and the child, and then ask the child two questions, what color do you see, and what color do I see, pre-operational children will answer both questions the same. That is, if the child is looking at the green side, he will correctly say he sees green, but he'll also say you're seeing green. He doesn't know that you are seeing the red side. He can't put himself in your shoes or see the world through your eyes. The child is still locked into his own perspective, which is still very egocentric, very preconventional, very self-centric. But the concrete operational child will correctly say, I see green, you see red. The child at this stage can take the role of other. And this is a huge step on the way to global, on the way to being able to take a world-centric perspective. The child is not yet fully there, but it is continuing to move in the right direction because it's beginning to see that its view is not the only view in the world. So its entire moral stance switches from a rather egocentric or pre-conventional stance to a conventional and awfully highly conformist stance, my country right or wrong, and law and order stage.
A fundamental change in worldview.
It's an entire change in worldview, a paradigm shift, if you like. And as with the three previous rungs, or the three previous paradigm shifts, this involves a profound change in self-identity, in moral sense, and in self-needs, to mention a few. At Fulcrum 4, pre-personal development gives way to the stages of personal development.
So in this way, each of the 9 stages of consciousness evolution is actually a paradigm shift.
In a broad sense, yes. Consequently, the typical adult in our culture has already undergone a half dozen or so major paradigm shifts, worldview shifts, from archaic to magic to mythic to rational to existential or thereabouts. You and I have already undergone these revolutions in consciousness. And although we might not remember any of the specifics, researchers on the scene report psychological earthquakes. We tend to seal these earthquakes out of awareness. There are a lot of very funny stories about this. If you take children in the pre-operational stage and, right in front of their eyes, pour the water from a short glass into a tall glass and ask them which glass has more water, they will always say the tall glass has more, even though they saw you pour the same amount from one glass to the other. They cannot conserve volume. Certain obvious things that we see, they do not and cannot see. They live in a different world space. No matter how many times you pour the same amount of water back and forth between the two glasses, they will insist the tall glass has more. If a few years later, after concrete operational awareness has emerged, you repeat this experiment, the kids will always say that both glasses have the same amount of water. They can hold volume in their mind and not be confused by its displacements. They have an internal rule that automatically does this, a concrete operational rule. And if you show them a videotape from the earlier period where they were saying that the tall glass has more water, they'll deny that it's them. They think you've doctored the videotape. They simply cannot imagine somebody thinking the tall glass has more water. So they underwent this massive paradigm shift, and not a bit of it remains in awareness. The self will now reinterpret every single event of its previous life history from the perspective of the new worldview. It completely rewrites its history from within the new and higher paradigm.
This concludes Session 3 of A Brief History of Everything by Ken Wilber. Our program continues with Session 4.